in Manila on Monday. The agreement was reached to coincide with U.S. President Obama's visit to the Philippines. Under the pact, the U.S. military will regularly send troops to the Philippines and will be allowed access to selected military facilities. The two sides also agreed to build or improve military facilities and infrastructure for joint use. The two countries say the numbers of U.S. troops to be deployed and specific plans to build new facilities will be decided through further consultations. Sources say the U.S. military could gain access to sites in the Subic Bay area on Luzon Island and facilities on Palawan Island. These locations face the South China Sea, where China is increasing its maritime activities. The Philippines once served as a major military stronghold for the United States, but U.S. troops withdrew from the country more than 20 years ago. Our correspondent says the new agreement, which strengthens the U.S. military presence in the Philippines, may be aimed at keeping China in check.
Meanwhile, China's foreign ministry has indirectly criticized the military pact just signed by the U.S. and the Philippines. Ministry spokesperson Qing Gang told reporters on Monday that China and the United States should share common interests over wide areas of the Asia-Pacific region. He said the two countries
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Our Democratic friends, for the most part, have been in the tank over Benghazi. They think it's to get me reelected. I mean, some guy said this about me yesterday on the left, that the only reason I cared about this was because I've got six Tea Party opponents. Well, if that's true, I'm the biggest scumbag in America. I don't think that's true. I know it's not true. It would be almost impossible for Lindsey Graham, given who I am and what I've been doing for the last 20 years, not to care about those in harm's way who get killed and not to want to hold administration accountable that lied about it.
Keep fighting the good fight. We need you, Senator Graham, on this and so many other issues. I always appreciate your ability to visit with us.
Yeah, the scumbags are the people in the White House who lied about this.
Boy, they sure have. And continue to do so. Unbelievable.
Thank
Thanks, Senator. Senator Lindsey Graham on the Mike Gallagher Show.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Rindigina.
Radio Intelligente Rindigina.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro. That's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginal.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Of all the different racists in the news right now. I mean, we've got Donald Sterling, we've got alleged Kansas shooter Glenn Miller, and others, but we do have some news from our good buddy cattle rancher Cliven Bundy. Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, who recently triggered this firestorm of controversy after suggesting that the Negro was better off, maybe, as a cotton-picking slave, is now saying that he is just like Rosa Parks. I mean, Lewis, you couldn't write anything this absurd, and he is saying it. He put out a press release a few days ago, and Bundy has this dispute with the federal government over grazing rights, which eventually led to an armed confrontation with federal rangers earlier this month, said that his fight against the government is just like Rosa Parks' stand against segregation. Here's a quote from a Bundy press release, okay? There's no doctored video. This is from his website. I am standing up against the federal government's bad and unconstitutional laws, just like Rosa Parks did when she refused to sit in the back of the bus. She started a revolution in America, the civil rights movement, which freed the black people from much of the oppression they were suffering. I am doing the same thing Rosa Parks did. I'm standing up against bad laws which dehumanize us and destroy our freedom. For more than 20 years, Cliven Bundy has been letting his cattle graze on federal land. The Bureau of Land Management claims that Bundy, who says he doesn't recognize the government's authority over the land, owes more than $1 million in fees, according to Reuters. And he seems to think that's the same as Rosa Parks. Remember, Cliven Bundy, privileged white millionaire rancher, won't pay for over 20 years of grazing fees despite a 90% federal subsidy and four court orders saying he needs to pay, who surrounds himself with an armed militia and threatens to destroy federal property and doesn't recognize the U.S. government, is exactly the same as that petite black woman who resents having to sit in the back of the bus because of her race, pays for the bus ride, and peacefully goes to jail. Lewis, do you see any similarities at all between Cliven Bundy and Rosa Parks?
I see one similarity, and that is that they are both taking a stand. against what and for what? Completely different.
They're both humans, right? That's another similarity. They both breathe air and presumably need regular food and water consumption to live.
I could take a stand against my glass of water, David, but it's not going to be productive. I don't think Bundy's doing anything to advance civil rights. I don't see it. He's completely delusional. This is completely nuts.
The saddest part is that there are any number, and it's actually the correct term here. It could be tens of thousands, it could be hundreds of thousands, it could be millions of people who agree that what Cliven Bundy is doing, if they think Rosa Parks did a good thing, right, which is no foregone conclusion for some people in this country, they really believe that Cliven Bundy is a hero in the same way that Rosa Parks was. And, you know, we don't really have to care that much about Clive and Bundy specifically, but the fact that in spite of the Negro might be better off as a cotton-picking slave, in spite of I'm just like Rosa Parks, he still has supporters. Maybe no longer Sean Hannity, but he still has supporters.
I wonder if saying things like this actually works. Maybe we should start doing this when we get hate mail. Just compare ourselves to someone or something and see what happens.
We would have to say that the way to do it is you're either like Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King, or you're like those fighting against Hitler. That's the other way to kind of bait with that type of thing.
I'm not sure it'll work for us, but we can give it a shot. It seems like a desperate act, though.
Internet radio for smarter originals.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com and ang-newswire.blogspot.com. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous News, Thought, and Analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliteral, neoliberal, neofascist, neomisogynist, and neo-homophobic control. I wish to welcome you all to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along. I wish peace to the gods and earths and love and solidarity to the entire original family in this time of strife and struggle. I'm your host, Angry Indian, and I'm here, as always, with my co-executive producer and studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales. And I'm just going to come clean. I almost was not here with everyone. It's just been a bad... It's just been a bad, bad few weeks. You know, I really don't know how to explain it and what to say, actually, other than I was supposed to go to Tasmania to, go back to Tasmania. And, I like Hobart. You know, there's places there that I like. But, you know, as the locals always tell me, well, you're not from here. So, you know, you find these things interesting. We don't, you know. To us, it's just fucking spiders, you know. So, who cares? Who gives a fuck, right? I mean, I was going to go to Tasmania. And then I found out that my oldest friend transitioned. So, excuse me. So, I ended up going to Philly to... deal with that and pay my respects, even though I haven't you know how it is. You don't keep in touch with people, you know. They move, you move, people get married, you know, they get divorced, right? You know, they go through all kinds of things, and you just don't really keep touch, not the way you say you were going to, right? Just don't keep touch. And but, you know, we always asked about each other, you know, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, known as Cat, 40 years, and, you know, he transitioned, and I went to be there, and, you know, as usual, you're home, and, you know, they say to you, you know, you can't go home, you know. And, you know, when you're young, you hear these things, it doesn't really, you know, doesn't really mean anything, doesn't say anything to you. And then, you know, as you get older, more and more people let you know, pass on. But the thing about it is, though, you know, we're supposedly part of a generation in terms of scientific advancement, in terms of technology, where, 50 today is not 50... like it used to be. You know, when I was a kid, people were 50, they were pretty much, you know, right? For the generation before that, a lot of people didn't make it to 50, you know, those Ellis Island families. You know, a lot of them didn't make the 50. You know, and before that, the industrial world here, no. You know, people didn't live very long. You know, folks passed away from illness, you know, starvation in a lot of cases, right? You know, just the stress of daily living in an industrial society. It does something to your lifespan. Now, you know, I'm not going to name anybody because, you know, I just, you know, I don't feel comfortable doing it. You know, he was my pal. And, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, I just wanted to bring up, you know, some of the observations that really got me, you know, going to this trip. Because, you know, part of this, you know, while I was in Philly, I fell ill. And so, you know, here was I was supposed to do one thing, right? You know, go to one place and ended up getting this news. And it was an obligation. You know, I really wanted to beat it. And, you know, going to do that. And some people are saying it was the stress. But, you know, this is, you know, like I just finished telling Bob Kincaid of Head On Radio, who you need to go check out, Bob Kincaid, headonradio.com. And see what he's doing over there with the... horn and everything else with the, you know, Best Progressive Radio coming out of West Virginia. You know, go check that out. But like I was saying to him, you know, these are occupational hazards that are catching up to me because, you know, time is moving, right? You know, what was, you know, dimples yesterday, today, you know, it's varicose veins, you know what I mean? And, you know, you get gray hairs in places you didn't really pay much attention to, really. So, it is what it is. But, yeah, okay, so you figure, okay, I'm looking a little bit at my own, you know, mortality. Especially, you know, as I'm sitting there and, you know, going through services and sitting at the wake and what have you. That I've known this, you know, this man more than 40 years. And, well, anyway, you know, let me just tell you the story. Because it's not a fucking, you know, happy story, and it's nothing to joke about. It's just, I want to illustrate something that a lot of us really just don't want to, you know, face up to. You know, for a lot of different reasons, and I can understand the reasons, and I'm not, coming down at anybody, and I'm not judging anyone. You know. But, you know, we need to talk about a lot of things that are going down, and we need to ask ourselves why we do what we do. Now, I'm going to talk about black people first, and then I'm going to talk about native people, because I belong to both communities. And I'm going to bring up some other stuff, you know, if it really ends up leading into it, because when I got back, you know, I was talking to Lupe about it, and, you know, as usual, we really never really know where to go when we come in here. And by the way, I came back and found out that she switched everything over to Linux. I don't know what do you call them? Distros? Distributions, what have you. Yeah, I don't know anything about that. But, you know, there's a learning curve for me because, you know, at home, I still have Windows, right? But in here, now everything is Linux. I thought Linux was stable. This thing seems to, you know, to kind of crash on us. It's been several times already, and it usually involves Firefox. So I don't know what's going on with that, but yeah, man, you know, I mean, a lot of people are complaining about Windows for a lot of reasons, you know, mostly the privacy thing, and then this whole Heartbleed. Yeah, while I was laying up, you know, everybody's talking about Heartbleed. I didn't know what the hell they were talking about, you know, because everybody looks at their goddamn devices, you know, they don't even look at you anymore. They look at their fucking device. So, you know, they might as well just put monitors or some shit in these things so that people can do what the fuck it is they do and then see where the hell they're going. You know, really. But anyway, yeah, so I'm going to talk about black people first, and I'm going to talk about native people in the United States, indigenous folks. Yeah, I know a lot of you don't like that term. You know, aboriginals. Yeah, I know a lot of you don't like that term. But you don't want to call yourself First Nations, right? Because that's Canada. That's something different, right? Well, anyway. You know, my friend, man. We had kind of lost touch at around the point of the story that I'm about to give to illustrate what I'm trying to talk about. because I've been thinking about this, you know, the whole time, you know, all of this has been going on, and now that I'm back, you know, and I'm at this mic, you know, it's like I never really know what I'm going to talk about, but then it's like, okay, I figured I would talk about this, and I really don't know why this is so difficult, but it is. You know, more than likely because I knew this cat, you know what I mean? And, you know, when I used to eat pork chop sandwiches and shit, I mean, that's, you know, that's the memories I have with this cat, you know, being hungry, being cold, you know, sitting in front of the barbershop and shit, you know what I'm saying? This, you know, this talking and trying to, you know, make the day pass, you know, because school was out and you couldn't really be in the house, you dig what I'm saying? So, you know, this is the cat he and I used to, you know, we were buddies out there, and when the, you know, the tougher kids used to come around, we used to have each other's back, you dig what I'm saying? We both got black eyes and shit for each other, so, you know, it's those kinds of things, you know, you don't forget somebody like that, you just don't, you know. So, there was a point where he got into a situation, and, it was one of these mistaken identity things, you know, basically somebody black, a black male did something, and he happened to be one of the black males who was in the vicinity, and because they didn't know which black male did it, they just took everybody in. And their way of finding out if, whether or not he was one of, you know, he was the one, or whether any of these, men were one of the people that they were looking for, you know, one of these young black males, you know, nondescript young black males. Well, they just beat the fuck out of all of them. And, I can't remember exactly how it went down, but he ended up, he wasn't convicted of anything. It ended up being, corrected because the person who was filing the complaint, the victim, what have you, finally identified who it was. And it turned out to be none of the group in which, you know, my homie was picked up with. Right? So, but, you know, they held him for a period of time. I don't know about the others, but they held him for a period of time. And, you know, his mother was frantic, and his family was really, you know, everybody was scraping up money trying to, you know, find a lawyer and what have you. And, yeah, it was really bad on him because after after they let him go, he was never the same again. He was never right ever again. I mean, it was very difficult for him to talk to people, family, friends. You know, when, I mean, we never had a falling out. It was just kind of like he just didn't want to talk no more. And it wasn't me. He didn't want to talk to nobody. And he never told us what happened to him. You know, I never found out the true story. And what I did find out really fucked me up. Spoke to his widow. And take into account that they hadn't been together for the past 8 years. Because his head was so fucked up that, you know, he got into alcohol first. Then he got into drugs. Then, you know, he was just in and out of shelters. Then his family, like his brother, had kind of, you know, grabbed him and cleaned him up. And he got him some housing, and then he found some employment, you know. But as things have, you know, the economy has gone down, well, same thing with him, you know. It's just, you know, it's just the bad news all the way around, and he slipped back into his thing. And what I heard was, see, they started talking about stop and frisk, I don't know, how long ago did the public become aware of stop and frisk? And usually they were just talking about New York City, right? Primarily. Well, that's mostly because of what the chief of police or whatever was saying, in terms of they were, you know, purposely seeking to intimidate, you know, black males. But in Philly, stop and frisk, whatever the fuck you call it, they were already doing that, man. You know, they've had points where you had to show, you know, your ID in order to go through a neighborhood, perhaps your neighborhood. Now I can understand them trying to stop the, you know, the whole drug thing. And, you know, yeah, but it's a band-aid stopgap measure. You know, whether stop and frisk or any of this other nonsense, you're criminalizing black men, basically, so to make a profit off them. You know, because one of the things, like I said, you know, when he first got in trouble, I mean, this was a long time ago. This was, you know, this is decades ago, you know. How old were we when that happened? I guess he was in his early 20s. And, you know, yeah. Yeah, you know, he was in his early 20s. And motherfucking, you know, I mean, you got bail money, you know, then you got lawyer money. You know, when you're working people, you don't have money for this shit. Well, who has the readies for this? You know, who the fuck really gets up and goes to work every goddamn morning? I mean, really, I'm not talking about the paper pushers. I'm talking about, you know, blue collar, manual motherfucking labor, flipping fucking burgers for some goddamn buddy. Do you have a lawyer on retainer? No, I didn't think so. So, you know, the family, I mean, they were selling things, and they were looking at selling their one vehicle, the station wagon. That I don't know if they would have ever been able to sell because it was, you know, I can't even understand how it ran at all. I mean, it was worse than a res car, but in any case, yeah, I know I'm going on tangents, but you know, try to roll with me on this. Well, what I'm trying to say is my friend died not from old age. Now we're up there. You know, we're creaking. You dig what I'm saying? I'm going to the doctor way more often than I fucking used to. You understand what I'm saying? But, you know, we're not lay intron, right? You know, we're not elderly. And homie really died of old age. You know, this black man died of old age. At the tender age of 50 fucking three, you know, how does that happen in the United States that supposedly has everything, that black people are dying of old age? I mean, who is it? Luke, the rapper. I know his face. He was on, Death Row Records of the, Suge, who had a series of strokes and then he died, right? That fucking Rick Ross. I'm not talking about the real Rick Ross. I'm talking about the fake ex-cop, ex-correction officer Rick Ross. I'm talking about the, you know, the Rick Ross talking about putting shit in a woman's fucking drink. That Rick Ross. How many strokes has he fucking had? How old is he? You know? I mean, he's what? In his 30s, right? His late 30s or some shit? He's not that old. I mean, you got black men on the East Coast. I think it was even New York City. Talk about 22, 23 years old, you know, strokes. Massive goddamn strokes. You know, there was somebody in Florida, I used to know. He said the young men over there in Miami are fucking having strokes. You know, I mean, what the fuck is that? And then I, you know, when I got laid up with my goddamn problem, you know, in Philly, which I don't goddamn recommend to anybody, yeah, I'm not gonna say that, you know, they didn't try to care for me. I'm just saying that the hospitals are fucking scary, these goddamn days. They're fucking scary. And then you got Mercer and all this other shit flying around. And all these other, you know, goddamn infections that you wouldn't fucking have if they didn't fuck with nature so goddamn much. But anyway. Yeah, there were so many young black people that were in there for kidney problems, liver problems. You know, this one cat, he couldn't have been no more than his like, what, 30. They were checking him for heart disease. You know, I didn't understand this. And you know what else fucking bothers me? And I told you this, Lupe, when I got back, right? What else bothers me is that, you know, the time I had to spend in there and go back and what have you, I kept hearing colostomy bag. And, you know, it's not the first time that I've experienced that. You know, and I've been trying to explain to a lot of goddamn people, you got to motherfucking watch what you eat. and lay off this bullshit about, well, you know, I only got one fucking life and I want to enjoy it. And if I want to eat fat, bacon, pork and all that kind of shit, I'll do what the fuck I want to do. Yeah, but you know, as somebody who believes in, you know, universal healthcare and shit, why should the rest of us have to fucking basically pay for your fucking being unhealthy? Because you end up obese. Because you end up in a fucking hover round and shit. Because you didn't even try to take care of your goddamn self. I'm not talking about pumping iron or fucking around with kettlebells or whatever the fuck else is trendy right now. And yeah, and that's another thing. That there were, so, there were some white guys that I saw in there who were sick, who were pissing blood because of goddamn, I forgot the name of that shit, right? The trendy thing. The fitness thing where they're training all day long, you know, 100 push-ups, 100 crunches or whatever, 100 free squats and what did you call it? No, not that, and not Pilates. Whatever it is, the thing that's fucking up people's kidneys because they're overtraining. Whatever it is. They were in there for that. And that was the other thing that I noticed on how many people had work done. What the fuck is going on with Philly, man? You know, everybody had work done. All of these women, you know, the nose work, the Botox. I mean, all of this shit is like a bad Twilight Zone goddamn episode, man. You know, and then on top of this shit, you know, my friend passes. And what I'm trying to get to is, you know, we're damaging ourselves. We're damaging ourselves by the way we're living, by the way capitalism is forcing us to live. Now, a lot of this had to do with what happened to him. But what really had to do with what happened to him is what the fuck happened to him. You dig what I'm saying? They traumatized him so goddamn much, whatever the fuck happened to him. Now, you know, a lot of us have known people that have gotten locked up, you know, they got sent for, you know, good, bad people, whatever the fuck. They got sent. And then when they came back, man, they were just completely motherfucking different. I know cats that have gone in service like that. They went to, you know, well, one fella I knew, he was supposed to go to Grenada and like he missed that. He was able to duck that. But they sent him on some other shit. And, you know, later on. And, he's somebody who really shouldn't have been in the motherfucking military to begin with. Yeah, you know, period. He's that type of personality. But he was trying to pay for a school. Which is something else. That, all of my friends, you know, children, damn near all of them are in the fucking military. You know, black people, you know, anyway, right? I mean, you know, the white folks I know, their kids were working. Or in school. You know, still in school, right? But they're all in the military because there's no fucking jobs. There's no fucking jobs. And they don't want to give people a decent motherfucking wage because the Republicans are voting down. At first I thought they were talking nonsense about it. And then you told me on Democracy Now, Luca, that, yeah, they voted against it. And then I saw something just last night, Tom Colbert talking some shit about, well, there should be no mandatory wage at all, that let the free market decide. So you know what would happen in terms of the Koch brothers and bastards like that. And it's not even them. But they're the people who are really, you know, calling the shots, right? So fucking, if they decide that this thing is only worth $2.23 an hour, that's what the fuck you'll get paid. Because the assumption is being made from the white collar people that this isn't going to happen to us. You know, they're right to a degree. You know, I mean, they're correct to a degree because, you know, the whole point of the middle class, because you don't hear me trying to defend the middle class. The whole point of the fucking middle class is to buffer the rich. And I don't know why capitalists in the United States do not understand that. I can say this to a capitalist in Canada, he gets it. I can say this to a capitalist in Mexico, he gets it. Right? Or I go to the fucking Obot and shit and talk in Tasmania. I can say it to them. They understand it perfectly. They understand everything. But the United States, no. There's no understanding. you know, there's no understanding that fighting for the middle class, fighting for what the mainstream media is telling you to fight for, is only keeping you in your place. It's keeping you where you're at. It's keeping the system exactly where it's at. No, I'm not jumping up and down for Obamacare, otherwise known as the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as the ACA, otherwise known as the plan that was come up with by the Republicans when they decided that everybody had to buy insurance. You know, yeah, the Obama administration fought for that because it was a Republican plan. When have they fought for anything that was a Democratic plan? They haven't. None of them have. And he's not addressing anything that I'm talking about right now either. How many black men have been damaged like my friend, who were never able to get their lives together after they ran into police racism? How many? You know, how many people out there completely lost? I mean, completely forgotten by the system, completely don't exist because they were picked up by the police because they decided to pick them up because they fucking felt like it. They weren't really trying to solve crime, because if they were trying to solve crime, they would solve all of the injustice at the root. Right? We would start talking about how when black folks were released from slavery during Reconstruction, they were released with nothing. No education, no land, 40 acres and a mule. That never really happened, did it? You know, General Grant came up with a field order. I can't remember the number of it. That basically it was supposed to allot land to freed slaves so they could take care of themselves. No, you can't do that. So, you know, slave lease. We'll just charge you with a crime and then still have you motherfucking work for us. And it won't be a goddamn thing you can do about it. And there wasn't a fucking thing we could do about it. There's still obviously not a goddamn thing we can do about it. You know, I mean, we got black people in justice. We got black people Secretary of State. We got black people, you know, all throughout the motherfucking, you know, branches. And now you got a, you know, African at the head of state. And you still can't get any justice on this shit. There are black men who were released from the joint who were picked up for bullshit in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s. Some of them were never released. You know, 60 Minutes had an episode like that where they were talking about these black men who were in prisons in the South, mostly Louisiana, I believe, and Georgia. But primarily, I believe it was Louisiana. Who, they knew that they were innocent of what they did, but they were like, well, they're so old now, what are we going to do with it? They don't have any family anymore. They were never educated. All they know was prison life. You know, what are we going to do? 80, 90, some odd year old man. Let them out now. And then when they have let some of them out, you know, if they didn't hurt themselves, you know, purposely because they were scared and confused and were never able to adjust. Nobody was trying to help them adjust. They just let them go, you know. Gave them $5, wrapped what was left of their gear in some brown paper, and told them, go ahead, George. Good luck. You know, I mean, there are people who have done 40, 50 motherfucking years, man, and they knew that they were innocent, but they're like, well, we're going to take care of them. Because that's why I remember the 60 Minutes episode, because that's what they told whoever it was. I don't remember who it was they sent to do the story. And he was like, well, you know, we're going to take care of him. You know, we're going to do that for him. You're going to do that for him. Like they're doing him a fucking favor. You know, so, yeah, man, yeah, man, you know, like I said, you know, I it's hard for me to talk about because, you know, the wife talked to me and she said that, you know, he was abused pretty bad and they had threatened him and, you know, apparently they threatened his family. They were going to hurt his mother, what have you, if he didn't confess. And, you know, kind of like what the Central Park, Central Park 5, because I remember when I first read about the story, I was angry too. I was like, hey, you know. Why should any woman have to put up with that kind of shit? But it turns out that she was attacked by somebody else and that they knew that they hadn't done it, but they had already gone so far that they needed to cover their tracks. So they're like, you're going to take the rap for this shit. I mean, I understand that everything was overturned, but these men spent time in the joint and the whole fucking, I guess, their whole city. I mean, I know the black community in Philly fucking hated them, right? You know. because we've had heinous violence down there like that, and it's just like, you know, after a while, you know, I mean, look, you know, white people who talk, you know, shit about, especially the OJ trial, because I don't even want to fucking hear it. They never proved a goddamn thing. You know, in terms, you know, I followed that shit when it was going on. I mean, I actually followed the fucking trial. And, you know, people like to say, well, he got off because, you know, they caught Furman lying. Not like, well, we caught Furman lying about violating people's fucking civil and human goddamn rights. You know, not the fact that he was a racist goddamn police officer who used his authority as a police officer to totally violate people because they were black or Spanish-speaking Indians. Otherwise known as Latinos. You dig what I'm saying? See, there's no talk about that. All they know is that OJ got away with what he did to that white woman. That's all they're thinking about. You know, not the fact that Furman knew the woman. Right? Or the fact that Goldman's, was it, three or four of his friends, they got caught up in a similar situation. And I remember Goldman's father having a press conference saying that, you know, do not connect this, that one doesn't have anything to do with the other. OJ's guilty. See, you know, because the first investigator that they brought onto that case, some European expert, I mean, you know, this was Hollywood, right? This is Brentwood. So, you know, they had to do it up. And they went and got this international investigator who said that there was more than one assailant on site. And it was a professional hit because the dog never heard anything. Everybody else was in the house. And, you know, yeah, you got this busy thoroughfare right in front. Nobody heard or saw anything. You know, and on top of that, supposedly there was another case similar to that of a record producer, right? Cocaine, right? Supposedly is involved in this. But no, nobody wanted to talk about that. Nobody wanted to talk about that or talk about the fact that, I'm sorry about that particular tangent, but talk about the fact that the majority of black people, the majority of minorities are convicted by majority black and majority minority court. I mean, juries. Because who are the people on the jury? People who got to take a day off and lose their regular, normal fucking day of pay for whatever, you know, pittance, you know, they give you at, you know, for being on the jury. Who the hell likes being on juries? I mean, you got some people who like to because they got nothing else to do, you know, because they sit and they watching old episodes of fucking Perry Mason and shit. And, you know, they get some kind of idea that they're going to be part of some big ass case and it's going to be exciting. You know, everybody that I've ever fucking known, you know, who got a notice for jury duty was like, God damn, you know, who the fuck wants to do that shit? You know, I mean, one, you know, you don't want to hear about these goddamn cases and shit. And then you'd ask you all kinds of fucking things. You know, do you believe in this? You believe in that? And they pick and choose, really, how the fuck they're going to, you know, who they're going to have for each particular case. So, you know, just because you get the notification doesn't necessarily mean they're going to put you on. You still got to take the time to go. So, you know, but motherfucking people don't, you know, if they haven't been through that bullshit, if they've never got a notice for whatever, you know, kind of thing, if you've never had to deal with that, you don't fucking realize that the majority of these black men that are doing time because you might have a white judge or what have you, but you got middle class people with jobs who are being underpaid right now to sit in judgment of somebody that they don't fucking know. That they don't know anything about the case. Now, you're supposed to be fucking objective. But, you know, if you're really going to do the Constitution, like that Clive Bundy goddamn moron I heard about while I was laying in the fucking, while I was laid up, you know, or anybody else, or these fuckers from the basketball teams and shit. And I don't know why you black people are goddamn surprised. You know that this bullshit is racist and you still want to be fucking involved in these fucking sports because you can't see any goddamn thing else, right? For yourself. So, you know, why be angry because these fuckers get caught saying this shit? This is how the fuck they feel. This is how they've always felt. This is how they've always felt. So, you know, why the surprise? You know, you don't realize this shit. So, in his case, I mean, I don't know what the race of the officers were, but let's face facts. If you live in any goddamn black, downtrodden community, any native fucking community, because remember, Indians are coming up next, you know, any native fucking community and shit, you know, the majority of people that are really going to be putting their foot in your fucking ass look like you. Now, yeah, I'm not saying that the white guys don't come in there and get their licks. Yeah, they're out there. I mean, what? You got a video on YouTube that, you know, a cop is breaking a fucking kid's arm on goddamn video. You know, I mean, you got people who are executed on video. They don't give a fuck no more. And you know what? Obama is going to say something about that execution because the cat, it was bots, and he ended up having a heart attack instead of dying the way he was supposed to because they want to experiment with these goddamn drugs. And I heard the motherfucker was a creep, but that's not how that shit's supposed to go. You dig what I'm saying? And so now Obama's going to say something because, you know, basically the white people who are upset about this shit are pushing it. But see, these same white people don't say anything about the fact that a black man is executed in this fucking country every 28 goddamn hours. Or that there's, 1,200 missing indigenous women and shit along the border from the U.S. and fucking Canada. And the Prime Minister Harper, he doesn't feel that he needs to say anything about that either. Because nobody on this end is saying anything about it. And not too many Indians are saying any fucking thing about it. So yeah, you know, to put a cap on what I started with, and I appreciate you for, you know, those of you who have hung on through this. But what I'm trying to say is, my friend basically did a slow suicide because whatever the fuck happened to him when they had him, they damaged him. And we've all heard the stories. Now, if you come from Sunnybrook Lane and you have a cul-de-sac where everybody's a lawyer or some other type of professional and shit, doctor, dentist, whatever the fuck, you don't know what the fuck I'm talking about right now. See, this is some shit you've heard in a rap song, maybe. See, when they weren't talking about bitches and dope and you know, one black man fucking over and stomping on another black man and taking everything that he has from him. And then, you know, sending flowers and shit to the widow and talking about he's a real motherfucking man and that he's a real nigga, right? You know, and you know, queen, you know, in one verse and bitch in the next and all that kind of shit. See, if you listen to the stories and tales of loss and woe in those goddamn things, you know, when you got a young cat, well, any motherfucking buddy, basically, they kind of look scared and they want to have some fun. You see, they'll take a motherfucker like that and throw him into a tank with a bunch of fucking no good goddamn pit bulls. Okay. They will throw somebody like that into a fucking situation and leave them in there. And now they got all this shit on film and everything, cameras. But, you know, sometimes cameras don't work, right? And even when they do have it on goddamn film, I mean, they don't stop any motherfucking thing. They just call for security. And, you know, you're on your own until these motherfuckers come down. And then if you try to fight back, if you're able to fucking fight back, then you both end up in the hole. But right now, I'm talking about he didn't even get that goddamn far. They just had him in the station house. And I don't know what the fuck happened to him, you know, mentally, I'm saying, you know, in terms of being able to relate, you know, I'm talking about what his wife told me when he eventually had broken down and told her, you know, he was in rehab for alcoholism and shit. And he just finally broke down and told her what they did to him. And, you know, I've been told, you know, that you can trigger shit in people by mentioning. So I'm not going to, you know. But I'm just going to say, you know, what was done to him was inhuman and fucking unforgivable. It was fucking unforgivable. And no, he never got over that shit. You know, because I know another cat, you know, I mean, we talk a lot about, or at least we've been talking a lot about sexual assault, and we should and we need to, because, you know, women are out here being fucked over, and it's a goddamn shame. But see, but what really gets me is, though, you will get, you know, there's a lot of talk about this, but there's not a lot of talk about the false charges, how people are falsely accused. You know, a lot of black men who have been released from the joint, you know, after the DNA came through and it turned out that the woman lied. Sometimes they're honestly mistaken, but sometimes they flat out goddamn lie. I mean, we just had a case like that. We talked about it here on the show, right, Lupe? The psychologist who works for the LA correction system, who wanted her boyfriend to move, and he didn't want to move. because there are black people moving in the area, and she didn't want to stay there. She wanted to go to a wider area of L.A., and he didn't want to. He wanted to stay with where they were. So she broke a window and said that she was raped by these guys and beaten up or sexually assaulted or what have you. And it turned out that it was a fucking lie, and they had rounded people up. I mean, she cut herself and everything. And dig this, and dig this. She kept her position. She kept her position as a psychiatrist. She still works for the LA correction system. It was what, the LA Times? Where did we read it? Because we definitely at one point had reported a snippet on. So, you know, I mean, we got stories like this, and nobody talks about this. On how many men, and like I said, how many black men are being released once they actually investigate the fucking case. I mean, you got to remember something, man. You got people who, you know, black men in particular I'm talking about now, who have been sent up because the officer said to the victim's family, whatever, that's the nigga that did it. And they said, okay. And they took your ass to the gallows or to the chair or to the gas chamber or, you know, put a chain on you and sent you out to build a fucking road or pick goddamn watermelons and shit, right? You know, to pay your debt back to society, right? So, yeah, man, you know, that's what happened to my friend, man. They fucked him up and they fucked his mind up. And he never got his life back again, okay? And it's goddamn raw. And I realized that, you know, he's one of many. But, you know, I want you to think about that. I want you to think about that. When motherfuckers talk about crime and punishment and shit, you know, what's the crime and who's doing the punishment? Who's getting the punishment? And who's profiting from the crime? And if we're going to get into discussions about crime, you know, Henry Kissinger is still walking about. Carlos Posada is still walking about in Miami. You know, are we really going to talk about crime? What about those officers who did all that damage on the Danziger Bridge during the Katrina crisis? How about all the other violence that was going on down there? Is anybody going to talk about that? See, no, I didn't think so. Now, I know I've had you all enough, man, but I want to talk about this. Now, I read the New York Times. I was looking at the New York Times magazine now last weekend, the Sunday Times. Well, this of course comes in with the magazine. For your records now, I want to make a note. Because I want people to look this up. This is the New York Times Magazine for the week of April 27th, 2014. Now, when you see the cover up, you're going to see a chimpanzee in a Western suit, talking about his day in court. And don't let that dissuade you from going further. What I want you to do is go to page 34. Story by Eric Konigsberg. Who killed Anna May? Now, if you're not aware of who Anna May Aquash was, she was an AIM activist and, you know, really serious, you know, Native American activist. You know, she worked with the black community in New England, I believe it was. She was a... I don't know. I mean, there's a lot to the story. There's two lives, actually. Ray Robinson Jr., you know, this was a brother, black man, who had worked with Dr. King, I believe in Chicago. And he decided to get a backpack and go with some people. And they were going to hitchhike and make their way into Rue du Nid during the siege in 1973. Now, he was never seen after that. The last report was that some of the warriors were kind of hostile. And yeah, you know, I know it's really hard to talk about this because you got people who are really, they either hate AIM or they love AIM. And what I'm asking people right now to do is to be objective and to look at AIM as any other, you know, organization during that time period under that type of pressure. You know, you have to understand something. You know, were there fuggish elements in AIM? Are there still fuggish elements in AIM? Of course. You know, were there fuggish elements in the Black Panther Party for self-defense? Of course. You know, I don't give a damn what political movement you got. For the most part, it's going to be led by the people who are the... you could say the tough guys, but basically the thugs. They're the people who want power. They're the people who are willing to do what it takes to get power. These are the people who are willing to hurt whoever. You know, because they're not paying these particular costs, and some of them are willing to pay any particular cost. They'll give up their own families in terms of power, in terms of money, to be a face. Now, if you're British, you know what I'm talking about. But, you know, to be a face, right? To be known, to be the big man, right? Or, you know, how do a lot of brothers put it? These young cats. I kept hearing this nice in Philly. Oh, man, that's JC, man. Yeah, that's like JC. You know, they talk about this man like he's a deity. When he flat out says, I'm not doing a fucking thing for you. I'm not here for you. I'm here for me. I'm here to do for self. You know, I mean, how many times has Beyonce performed for Republicans? You know, for Democrats who were really Republicans were posing as Democrats. You know, I mean, you notice that they managed to weasel themselves in with every, you know, political administration that comes in. You know, if Palin had won, you know, Destiny's Child probably would have still performed for the McCain-Palin ticket. So, you know, it's a tangent, and we're talking about Native people, and why not talk about Sarah Palin, who is receiving Indian health insurance because of her husband's background for her child, even though she doesn't want you to have welfare. She doesn't want you to have minimum wage and any kind of government services, but she will have the Indian health service pay for her child, her Republican child's deal. I'm just saying, right? And McCain, if you remember the McCain-Udall bill, where they started moving Indian people, elders, right, Dinier people, into Northern California so that they could put a nuclear waste dump on their territory, where they've been for how many damn thousands of years, right? Remember Thomas Bankaya, the elder, the last one, the Hopi timeline, that area, that region. You dig what I'm saying? McCain and Indians. McCain doesn't give a fuck about Indians. And Palin doesn't give a fuck about Indians either, in Alaska or on the mainland. You know, she doesn't. She never has, and she never goddamn will. But Beyonce would have performed for her. She would have twerked for her anyway, because they go for the power. They're going for the power. So what I'm saying is, in terms of the American Indian movement, you know, you had legitimate anger here. Nobody ever gave natives the motherfucking land back, right? How many natives are in the goddamn Marine Corps, fucking Army Airborne and shit? How many are in Iraq and Afghanistan serving right now? I mean, Laura Paestua, you know, they wanted to, you know, I mean, look, native people, you know, we're a conservative culture, man, and I understand. You know, the people want to talk about her patriotism, this and that. Look, man, she went in there to put food on the table. So did Jessica Lynch. Right? Poor white girl from the hills, man. She was trying to put food on the table. Just like I said with all these young people, you know, the children of my friends, they're in the military because they can't find jobs. Because, you know, they either work at McDonald's, if they could even get McDonald's, and that's something else I'm going to bring up, because there was a lot of tension I noticed out there. Because, well, there's a hell of a lot more Mexicans up there than before. And, you know, I have experienced this myself, you know, trying to get a dishwashing job. And they're like, well, you don't speak enough, you know, Mexican Spanish anyway. You know, Puerto Rican shit didn't count out there. And you know, it was just like, look, you know, you had a lot of legitimate anger for a lot of things. And there's a lot of it is confusion. And it's confusion brought about by the powers that goddamn be. You know, if you're born and raised in the United States, I mean, yes, it would behoove you to learn another lingo, right? It would behoove you to expand your parameters and be able to, you know, learn another language. But you really shouldn't have to be required to speak another language to work in your own country. I'm sorry. If I go to live in France, I have to learn French. If I go to Italy, I have to learn the time. You dig what I'm saying? If I go to Chile, I have to fucking, you know, learn their Spanish. You know, I mean, people will try to help you. I mean, if they're decent and whatever. But, you know, there's a problem here that a lot of people are not talking about. And now blacks are getting caught up in this because we know for a goddamn fact we're not going to get anything out of the browning of America. You know, we think we are because we're looking at the parties and shit that are going to happen. And the food is going to be a little fucking better. And, you know, the women are going to be much different. You dig what I'm saying? And you know, television and music and shit like that is going to change, and it's going to look a lot more like Brazil. I understand that. You understand that. But see, here's the fucking thing, though. Niggas in Brazil don't get treated any better than niggas do in the United States and Canada or Mexico, for that goddamn matter. And I know a lot of black folks don't think, you know, especially in the States, in terms of Veracruz and Oaxaca, in terms of black people and shit. In Mexico City, you know, in terms of black folks, they just don't think of the diaspora like that. You know, they don't think in terms of Puerto Rico, Cuba, Dominican Republic, right? They don't think of Haiti. They don't think of the Virgin Islands. None of that shit. You know, it just doesn't register. You know, but you know what they do know, though, from historical fucking experience, though, is that, you know, here when other groups come in, black people end up getting pushed out unless they kiss ass and start acting really, really white. And I'm saying it like that because that's the truth. You know, I mean, like, a lot of people get on me for knocking the Mindy Project. A lot of fucking people got on me back home for knocking the goddamn Mindy Project and several other fucking things. You know, I mean, this is the first time I went home and somebody actually called me a fucking kike. I mean, I couldn't even fucking believe that shit. Rupert, right? You know, I told you, I couldn't fucking believe this. I mean, this was a black guy, but he's reading the goddamn protocols of the Elders of Zion and shit, which of course is ludicrous. You know, it's like, what the fuck is wrong with you, man? You know, what the hell is wrong with you? But I'm just saying, you know, people are flipping out because they're feeling a crunch. I mean, you're watching white people flip out. You know, this Clive Bundy and this other motherfucker who owns this goddamn sports team, this basketball team in the NBA. You know, I mean, come on, man. You know these motherfuckers think like this. You're just a cash cow to them. Why do you, I mean, who gives a fuck about you taking your damn team jacket and turning it inside out and throwing it on the center court? Who gives a fuck? You're still working there because you're not going to turn the goddamn money down, right? Because you put all your eggs in one goddamn basket. Sports. Or singing and motherfucking dancing, right? Or doing a Mike Tyson thing where I can't do anything else, so I'm just going to knock motherfuckers out. You know, which was something else. Went to go check out the damn boxing center. Geechee Man's, you know, boxing center, right? That was gone. That closed down. I thought his son was going to keep that. Marvin was going to keep that going. That didn't. That's gone. But, you know, George Foreman, Ali had education. Ali was not, you know, he came, he lived in a house. Ali lived in a, you know, in a detached house. He had, you know, parents that were, you know, still together and who had regular, you know, who had, you know, consistent jobs. And I believe they had a bank account. You know, well, they had to have a bank account. They had a house, right? So, you know, it wasn't like me coming out of public housing or, like I mentioned Mike Tyson earlier, you know, he came out of a really bad neighborhood, out of a real ghetto. So, you know, it wasn't like that. And I mean, I can't fucking believe I'm forgetting his name. No, not Foreman. See, I'm having a senior goddamn moment, you know, and I apologize, which is probably why I went on a tangent. As opposed to what the fuck it is here I want to talk about. Because, yeah, I was talking about Ray Robinson and I got into some other shit because he was black and he went to move the knee. And evidently, the Warriors were pissed with him. Now, people have said who knew him that he was the type that he'll get into the argument with you real quick. Real quick. And you know how a lot of activists are, because this happened during Wounded Knee. Because I've spoken to people who were actually there. I'm not talking about people who were... No, people who were actually goddamn there. And, you know, fucking... And there were white people who had showed up that, you know, nobody fucking invited. He said that, you know, like people told me, you just see them coming over the ridge waving and shit. And then, you know, there'd be, you know, stuff going back and forth. And they're just completely oblivious to the fact that people are taking pot shots at. So, you know, so it's like, nah, man. Nah. You know, all I'm saying is that, you know, people need to be honest about what really went down and the conditions that led to that situation. Now, in terms of Ray Robinson Jr., it turns out that, because I'm reading this here in the Times, and I want you to read it, that he got stabbed in the knee after getting into an argument, and one thing led to another. Now, one of the other stories that I've been told or privy to, can't remember if I read it or this one was told to me, I believe I read it someplace, because, you know, in Indian country, especially if you're black, nobody wants to talk about Ray Robinson Jr. And if they're Lakota, it might actually probably get you into a physical altercation. I mean, you know, nobody wants to discuss it. And it's pretty clear why nobody wants to discuss it. Because it's pretty clear that, you know, I mean, I've heard, you know, when you go through the Midwest, man, you know, you hear monkey quite a bit. And, you know, Native people are not, it's not unheard of for Plains Native people to call you, you know, a monkey. It's not unheard of. You know, some people have told me that a lot of people picked that up in the military, and there might be something to it. Because, you know, they don't know anything about black folks in some of these communities, because there are no black people in these communities, right? You know, it's like, you know, people who hate Jews, but there's no Jews where you live. You don't know anything about Jews. It's something that somebody said to you. You know, like the jerk that called me a fucking kike. He is reading the protocols that Elders designed. And he knows that I'm a quarter, you know, European. But I don't know what happened. You know, we were discussing something, and I think I said something in Yiddish. I can't even remember what it was that I said, because I don't speak Yiddish. My mother spoke it. I know what I hear, and I know words. You know, Yiddish. I don't know. Like, I speak Spanglish, Yiddish, right? So anyhow, I don't know, I said smock, schlock, something, you know, book, I don't know, whatever it was I said. And he was like, "Are you Jewish?" And I'm like, "Huh?" And he's like, are you Jewish? I mean, like, he just got, "Are you Jewish?" And I'm like, "Partly, yeah, why?" And then he didn't say anything. And then, you know, later on, started asking me these fucking questions about what did I tell you, Luke? It was dumb. We had started talking about police brutality. Then I don't know what the fuck happened. He got onto that the Jews control the police department. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? And one thing led to another. He called me a fucking kike. And I'm like, where'd you learn that word? Well, you know why I'm saying that, because it's not really a word that black people use. You know, it's just, in terms of Jews, I've heard Jew boy, you know, shit like that. But kike, yid, you know, like, in Jersey, I used to hear that. But it was never directed at me, you know, it was directed at other people. But, cause, you know, when people look at me, they don't think about that shit. Yeah, you know, this hate, this fucking hate, man. You know, hate and anger because of confusion. And in the case of Ray Robinson, you know, the story that, you know, one of the stories that I heard was, is that, yeah, sorry about that tangent. But, you know, one of the stories I heard was, is that he showed up and refused to fight and started talking like pacifism to them and shit. And they didn't want to hear it. And one thing led to another. I don't know how a disagreement about pacifism leads to somebody, losing their life, though. You know, that I do not understand. And somebody will have to fucking explain that to me, because I do not understand that. But, because their enemy was not him, per se, you know. And yeah, you know, he might have, been an annoyance, and they didn't want him there. And maybe they didn't want him, some of them didn't want him there because he was black. Because I have heard that too. That, you know, from Native people, that, you know, there was, some ambivalence to him being there, because they're like, what does this nigga want? Now, whether they actually said that to him or whatever, you get my drift. And, you know, I don't know what happened. But now, because there's more attention on that case, there's more information popping up about Anime Akwash. So, like I was saying, you know, she was the sister, really strong sister, man, and very committed to the movement. And I guess she, you know, I guess it's established fact now, because you can talk about this shit, now that Means isn't with us any longer, that she was down with Means. and you know, she was having an affair with him and all this kind of shit, and that she was basically, you know, really in close with the people who were making decisions. Now, a lot of this depends on how seriously you take the American Indian movement, especially at that time, as a real threat. Now, yeah, there was the takeover of the federal building down in D.C., which was how, you know, Native people found out how we were being jacked, you know, in terms of actually being able to look at the papers, you know, within the Bureau of Indian Affairs, you know, ourselves. Because, you know, they had mimeographed all that stuff and started giving copies out. So people got to see what the hell was really going on in terms of their money. And if you look at the Colbell case, you can see we will never see that money. And even with that money, just like I was saying before, how many of those families were, I mean, that case was a big case and it was in the billions. But how many Indian people were actually going to be recipients of that? You know, who did those people really represent? It represented Indian landholders. I mean, yeah, there were people who were really cut out of things. But for the most part, you know, there was the way it was explained to me that was a Native American elite in the United States. Or a faction of it anyway. Because, you know, when you go to Cherokee country, I mean, you got some people who have a lot of money. You know. And then you have other people who don't have any goddamn thing. And, you know, here on the West Coast, you got bands, tribes, you know, groups. If you're Cherokee, there's like, I don't know how many goddamn associations. Most of them are just, you know. I mean, as far as being legit, if you go by what they say with the BIA, none of them are legit. Right? But there's just so many of them because there's so many people, you know, claim to be. I mean, it's just a dime a dozen when it comes to Cherokees in North America. I mean, fuck. A buddy of mine went to Bristol in the UK and said there was a fucking powwow there. And there were like 15, 20 people who he said, yeah, I didn't challenge them or anything, but they said that they were Cherokee. You know. He's Duwamish, the fellow I'm thinking about right now. But he said, yeah, that's what they were saying. And they had a drum and they had all this stuff. He said they were making fry bread. He said, you know. I mean, I've known people, you know, from Germany. Really in the natives, man. I mean, they had teepees in their backyards and shit. It's a big thing. You know, I don't know what was going on with that. But in any case, talking about Ray Robinson Jr. And about what happened to Anna May. But, you know, like a lot of people, I have, because if she was as in the inner sanctum of the operative AIM movement, which would be Dennis Banks, the Belcourt brothers, all of the snitches and shit that were around them. You know, I mean, how was it? Doreen Martin is that one of the names? I mean, because Walt Churchill has written about this extensively. Because, I mean, it's just like what's going on between the Crips and the Bloods in L.A. and really, for the most part, all over the goddamn country. But you know what I'm talking about. Mostly, you know, in Compton, in that part of Los Angeles. You know, if that was another ethnic group, if they were Greeks or some shit, or if it was like, say, Albanian Jews going at it, they would call it a civil war. 30 years? 30 years of mayhem like that? They would call it a civil war. It would be looked at as a political issue. And it should be any goddamn way. Since it started off as a political issue, I mean, the whole point behind the Crips, they called themselves, at least in the beginning, that was supposed to be a takeoff from the Black Panther Party for self-defense. But look at what happens. You want to jump to a militant stance, right? And then you get rid of all of the leaders. You liquidate all of the leadership. But the guns are still there. So they know what's going to happen. The thugs are going to come because they want the power. Okay, and there's nobody to keep them in line. There's no one to keep discipline. So what you have is complete fucking chaos. I mean, I just watched a documentary earlier this afternoon about Afghanistan. And it's everything that every veteran has fucking told me. I mean, all they did was confirm. It was a British documentary, of course. Ben Johnson, I think his name is, working for Vice.com, which they're doing some real journalism. You really need to check that shit out. Vice.com. It's the new modern media that's all shocked. But I mean, they actually go places where these mainstream fuckers don't go. And in this case, they ran excerpts from this cat's film about his being an embedded journalist in Afghanistan, man. And fucking the Afghan troops are their fucking joke. It's just like what you see with Africans and shit. You know, clowns and bullies and thugs running around with all these fucking weapons and shit, intimidating people. I mean, and what was really bad about what was going on in Afghan, I mean, I had the feel for the fucking the Marines that were part of this this documentary, because they have to work with scumbags. They have to not only work with fucking child abusers and shit and drug dealers. Knowingly, because I mean, many of you have been aware of the stories that have leaked about how many young people are being abused in Afghanistan by these goddamn Afghan troops. They're lowlives of the worst motherfucking order. And if there was any other situation other than the Catholic fucking church, people would be upset and there would be demands for investigations. Like, what was it that came up when Rumsfeld was giving some testimony to her mind is in she's in my mind's eye, Cynthia McKinney, when it turned out that DynCorp knew that they were prostituting and trafficking in young people, and the DynCorp knew this and still paid these people and still did business with them. It's a goddamn shame. And, you know, there's no fucking excuse for this. But, you know, they'll find excuses, though. And they'll, you know, they'll find excuses and they'll just come up with some kind of, you know, what did Rumsfeld say? Well, you know, they put them in a box, a penalty box, and if they're good for 2 or 3 years, then they can get out of the penalty box. A penalty box? You're supposed to lose your entire fucking business when you're connected to some shit like that. You're supposed to lose every fucking thing. Every fucking thing. Fuck the contracts. You lose your fucking charter. You lose your business license. You get banned from the fucking industry for life. That's what the fuck is supposed to happen with some shit like that. But that's not what happened. And I know a lot of you are asking, what the fuck does this have to do with anime, Aquash? What I'm trying to say is, what anime Aquash was fighting for was justice. But see, we're in a system that where there is no fucking justice. And because those of us who are fighting for justice, I mean, I'm starting to basically understand that we don't know what justice looks like. We don't remember what justice looks like anymore. Okay, I'm embarrassed that after all of these fucking, you know, years, that the New York Times has finally done a story on Anime Aquash, right? In the Sunday magazine. But you had native people who have had the ear of the media, the ear of journalists in you know, positions of influence and what have you. You got Indians talking about casinos all goddamn day long. Did they mention Anime Aquash? No. Did they mention Lenin Peltier? No. How many black politicians mention Mumia Abu-Jamal? None. How many of them mention every 28 hours? None. When was the last time the Black Congressional Caucus said anything about any goddamn thing? But they'll stand up for Israel, but did they stand up for black people? No. No. So, you know, it's embarrassing to me as a native person that, you know, the New York Times is doing this and they're going to get the credit for bringing this story out. I'm not talking about journalistic credit. They're going to get the moral credit because native people didn't do it. And don't think the white people are not going to say, well, you guys didn't do anything. And I'm not saying that there are not native papers who have not brought it up, but they were so busy trying to, you know, hang the American Indian movement that no one's talking about what happened, how she got badjacketed in the first place, who badjacketed her, if that's what happened. See, we got two cases here, right? We got the Indian racism that happened, or the possible Indian racism that happened to Ray Robinson Jr. Look, we know something happened. What we don't know is what the fucking why. That's what we don't know. and nobody in Indian country wants to talk about it because, see, it's embarrassing because here it is, you're being treated like shit, but then, you know, you had a racist situation that was supposed to be bound with a liberation movement. See, the two don't gel, right? And then if you got, you know, people who are being taken out by their own people because they've been badjacketed because people are nervous, right? So what I'm trying to say is, just like with my friend, man, there's a lot of residual damage that goes along with this. There's residual damage because we can't talk about it. If my friend had been able to talk to somebody about what happened to him and he could have gotten some help, maybe he'd be sitting next to me here in the fucking studio. Instead, he just continued to hurt himself because he was in pain because nobody was listening. And he lived in a society that didn't want to hear it. Because nobody wants to talk about your manhood being taken from you, right? Because we don't want to have that discussion. We'll talk about Rick Ross all motherfucking day. And, do I even want to go here? No. But let's just say, you know, oh, fuck it, I'm going to do it anyway. I mean, goddamn R. Kelly. I mean, you got people, you know, who, women, who still want to, you know, fucking, admire and buy $75 and $110 goddamn tickets to see, a Rick motherfucking Ross or goddamn R. Kelly and shit. No. Why is that able to happen? You know, why is that able to happen? You know, I mean, look at this whole pimping and hoeing thing. Why is this allowed to go? Right? Residual fucking damage. You get so used to being taken advantage of, you can't see another motherfucking way. And it makes you react. Because, you know, you're not responding, you're reacting. Two different concepts. And in my, you know, in terms of my, you know, my pal, he reacted. He was never able to take control of his situation. He didn't have the social political power to do that. And he knew it. So, you know, he went from, I suppose, from what she was telling me that he told her, because, you know, a lot of this happened, you know, before they met, that he went from just trying to get through the day to basically not wanting to get up at all. And the hustling, you know, for his addictions and shit is what, you know, basically propelled him to get through the day. Residual fucking damage. And then, you know, we have native people and shit. You have, you know, 1,200 missing indigenous women over a 30-year period. The, you know, RCMP doesn't seem to feel that they can or should bother to do anything about it. The public doesn't demand that they do anything about it. On either side of the border up there, you got indigenous women nobody even knows to count on the other side of Mexico, right? These border towns. Why aren't we saying anything about this? Well, residual fucking damage. Because you figure if you say something, the white people will cut what little water you have off, right? Because the casino motherfucker's not going to say anything. Because he knows if he says anything, he loses his business. He doesn't get any support from the municipality anymore. You dig what I'm saying? All those guys that are smoking cigars and shit, he doesn't have their patronage anymore. And that tribal family that runs the casino, they know that. Those tribal leaders that run things, they know that. You know, they don't take that money and send it their young people out to get educated to come back and like improve the community. No, they hire white people from outside of the community to run the affairs of the nation while they watch their community implode. That's what they do. So instead of, you know, trying to find out what happened to Anna Mae Quash and how this relates to missing indigenous women, doesn't it, you know, we don't say anything. And then those that say something, we don't really support them. But if they win a hip-hop contest, though, that's all we can talk about. Now, you know, I know that people are going to be pissed off by what I said, but look, I'm, you know, you have to take what I'm saying, you know, and generalize with intelligence. We have a lot of problems here. We have a lot of problems that we're not fucking discussing. There's a backstory to every fucking thing. Find the goddamn backstory. Now, like I said, you know, the only reason I've been talking about being Jewish over the past couple of years is just because I've basically been trying to face it myself. Because there are certain cultural aspects to me. You know, like I said, what got me in trouble when I was, you know, back home was fucking speaking Yiddish. Speaking Yiddish to a fucking smuck. You know. Who, you know, to me, as a black man, should goddamn know better. But he's not working. I found out that he's been out of work for damn near 4 years and shit. So now he's out of work. He's getting into all these crazy goddamn, you know, ideas that the Jews are controlling everything. That's why he doesn't have a job. That's why he's not working. I mean, yes, it's true that a ridiculous amount of goddamn money is given to Israel every fucking day. And political capital that can't even be fucking mentioned. That's true. But that's not why you're working. It's simply because of capitalism. Not because of Jews. But somebody, somewhere that he goes, is telling him this shit. And he believes this. And it was impossible to reason with someone like that. Because, you know, then the Holocaust didn't happen and shit, you know, and it's that, well, let's be clear here, the European Holocaust, right? And then, you know, once you start dealing with somebody that says shit like that, there's nothing left to say. There's nothing left to say. You know, there's nothing left to say to somebody, you know, at that fucking guy's age, in his mid-fucking-30s, to say something like that. I mean, what it says to me is that the education system isn't doing a goddamn thing. Because, see, what they do is, instead of talking about the human tragedy of what the fuck went down in Europe in the middle of the goddamn last century, and how the Christian world sat there and watched, okay? How the Christian capitalist Western world sat and fucking watched that. You know, they don't talk about that. They don't talk about the moral issues of that. The socio-political fucking hatred. The Catholic root of anti-Jewish hatred in Europe. See, they don't talk about that. They talk about how Muslims hate Jews. Which that's happened because of what Christians have fucking done. You see, no one's going to discuss that. Jews used to be safe in Muslim countries. Right? That changed. You know, after 1948, that changed. Because Christians decided, well, this is what we're going to do for our own political needs. Because we needed an ally in the area. And this political group, talking about Zionists, not Jews, talking about Zionists. Talking about David Ben-Gurion and Chaim Weizmann and those cats. They were like, yeah, okay, we'll make you a deal. You put it, you know, you look out for our interests and you can have it. You know, they talk about Israel and how they got to defend themselves against Palestinians. And that, you know, the United States has to pay for this. Because this is the stuff that he was relaying to me. But, you know, the whole idea of why Jews feel that they even need a country and were willing to make a deal with the devil like that and to do genocide after genocide was done to them so that they could have a country, he knew none of that information and then got angry with me because he couldn't keep up with me. You know, which really ruined my goddamn evening and my visit and everything else, you know. Because I asked him, I said, you don't even know what the fuck kike means. And for those of you who really don't know, this is the way it was explained to me. Most immigrants to Ellis Island, I believe, they were marking X. You know, they couldn't, it's not that they didn't know English. They didn't know anything. You know, they couldn't read or write in their own languages. So, you know, you give your mark, right? Put an X. Well, for some reason, a lot of Ashkenazim will put a circle. And, in German, was it Kickel? Said, you know, circle. So kike, you know, whatever. A lot of Germans here, right? So, you know, that's, and those prejudices, you know, that's what happened. I mean, there was an exclusion act against Jews. There was an exclusion act against Italians. There was an exclusion act against Greeks. There was an exclusion act against Chinese. You know, the Irish. I mean, nobody really talks about this shit. Nobody wants to talk about it because it's goddamn embarrassing. I mean, how are you going to say you got a free country that was based on slavery and the genocide of indigenous people? You know, we're dealing with a lot of residual goddamn bullshit. So, you know, okay, you know, Loopy's telling me to go. So, yeah, I've talked enough. Look, you know, think about the fuck's going on around you. You know, try to find out what the hell's going on. You know, avoid the surface. And I'm not saying not to look at it, but just realize it's just that. The surface is the surface. You go beyond that. You go deeper than that. You look. You ask goddamn questions. And you don't just simply believe anything just because you've been told it. This is the Angry Indian. And you've been listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid from The Horn. Head on RadioNetwork.com and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
HIV संक्रमितहरूलाई माया, ममता र समाजमा सम्मानित जीवन जिउने वातावरण निर्माण गरौं।
यो उनीहरूको अपेक्षा होइन, अधिकार हो।
रोगलाई तिरस्कार र बहिष्कार गरौं, रोगीलाई होइन। एचआईभी अरूलाई मात्र होइन, तपाईलाई पनि लाग्न सक्छ।
सकारात्मक सोच, स्वस्थ समाज अनि सही निर्णय नै सरल तथा सफल जीवन हो।
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास।
Hello, I'm Carol Warden. The Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center asked for your help in spreading awareness of the National Public Awareness Campaign for the availability of Plan B within Indian Health Service. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that is routinely denied to Native women at IHS facilities. Although Plan B has been available without a prescription for adult women since 2006 and as of 2009 available to women age 17 and up, it is still not provided over-the-counter at 90% of IHS pharmacies. Our goal is to ensure that Plan B is available as an over-the-counter contraceptive for all Native women and to incorporate access to Plan B into standardized sexual assault policies within IHS. We also seek to inform Native women of their right to Plan B so that they are able to make informed decisions regarding their reproductive health. Please help us get the word out. Native women are entitled to the same level of health care as all other women. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 100.1 en FM.
This is Ed Asner. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, and tortured, targeted civilians, and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Hi, this is Annie from Avoir Simone. You're listening to a Creative Commons licensed podcast.
Great, thank you. So good to be here. And thank you for the invitation to be here to speak, and especially to my friend Anthony Arnove. I'm delighted especially to be here on the 4th of July. Which is an appropriate day to talk about Empire Obama and America's Last Taboo. I'm sorry the title's a bit wordy, but I couldn't get it down to something as it should be. Now, 2 years ago, I spoke at Socialism in Chicago about an invisible government, which is a term used by Edward Bernays, one of the founders of modern propaganda. It was Bernays who, in the 1920s, invented public relations as a euphemism for propaganda. And it was Bernays, deploying the ideas of his uncle, Sigmund Freud, who campaigned on behalf of the tobacco industry for women to take up smoking as an act of feminist liberation, he calling cigarettes tortures of freedom. At the same time, he was involved in the disinformation that was critical in overthrowing the Arbenz government in Guatemala. So you have the association there of cigarettes and regime change. The invisible government that Bernays had in mind brought together all media, PR, the press, broadcasting, advertising, and their power of branding and image making. In other words, disinformation. And I suppose I'd like to talk today about this invisible government's most recent achievement, the rise of Barack Obama, and the silencing of much of the left. But all of this has a history, of course, and I'd like to go back, take you back some 40 years to a sultry and, for me, very memorable day in Vietnam. I was a young war correspondent who had just arrived in a village in the central highlands called Thuy Long. My assignment was to write about a unit of U.S. Marines who had been sent to the village to win hearts and minds. "My orders," said the Marine sergeant, "are to sell the American way of liberty as stated in the Pacification Handbook. This is designed to win the hearts and minds of folks as stated on page 86. Now, page 86 was headed in capital letters, WHAM, winning hearts and minds. The Marine unit was a combined action company, which, explained the sergeant, meant, and I quote, "We attack these folks on Mondays and we win their hearts and minds on Tuesdays," unquote. He was joking, of course, but not quite. The sergeant, who didn't speak Vietnamese, had arrived in the village, stood up in a jeep, and said through a bullhorn, "Come on out, everybody. We got rice and candies and toothbrushes to give you." This was greeted by silence. "Now listen, either you gooks come on out, or we're going to come right in there and get you." Now the people of Thuy Long finally came out, and they stood in line to receive packets of Uncle Ben's Miracle Rice, Hershey bars, party balloons, and several thousand toothbrushes. Three portable, battery-operated, yellow-flush lavatories were held back for the arrival of the colonel. And when the colonel arrived that evening, the district chief was summoned, and the yellow-flush lavatories unveiled. The colonel cleared his throat and took out a handwritten speech. "Mr. District Chief, and all you nice people," said the colonel, "what these gifts represent is more than the sum of their parts. They carry the spirit of America." I promise you I'm quoting verbatim. "Ladies and gentlemen, there's no place on earth like America. It's the land where miracles happen. It's a guiding light for me and for you. In America, you see, we count ourselves as real lucky as having the greatest democracy the world has ever known, and we want you nice people to share in our good fortune. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, even John Winthrop's City Upon a Hill got a mention. All that was missing was the Star-Spangled Banner playing softly in the background." Of course, the villagers had no idea what the colonel was talking about, but when the Marines clapped, they clapped, and when the colonel waved, the children wave. And when he departed, the colonel shook the sergeant's hands and said, "We've got plenty of hearts and minds here. Carry on, sergeant." "Yes, sir." In Vietnam, I witnessed many scenes like that. I'd grown up in faraway Australia on a cinematic diet of John Wayne, Randolph Scott, Walt Disney, and Ronald Reagan. The American way of liberty they portrayed might well have been lifted from the Wham handbook. I'd learned that the United States had won World War II on its own and now led the free world as the chosen society. It was only later when I read Walter Lippmann's book, Public Opinion, A Manual of the Invisible Government, that I understand that I began to understand the power of emotions attached to false ideas and bad histories on a grand scale. Now, historians call this exceptionalism, the notion that the United States has a divine right to bring what it calls liberty to the rest of humanity. Of course, this is a very old refrain. The French and British created and celebrated their own civilizing missions while imposing colonial regimes that denied basic civil liberties. However, the power of the American message was and remains different. Whereas the Europeans were proud imperialists, Americans are trained to deny their imperialism. As Mexico was conquered and the Marines sent to Nicaragua, American textbooks referred to an age of innocence. American motives were always well-meaning, moral, exceptional. As the colonel said, there was no ideology, they said, and that's still the case. Americanism is an ideology that is unique because its main feature is its denial that it is an ideology. It's both conservative and it's liberal. And it's right and it's left. And Barack Obama is its embodiment. Since Obama was elected, leading liberals have talked about America returning to its true status as, and I quote, a nation of moral ideals. Those are the words of Paul Krugman, the liberal columnist of the New York Times. In the San Francisco Chronicle, columnist Mark Morford wrote, and I quote, spiritually advanced people regard the new president as a light worker who can help usher in a new way of being on the planet, unquote. Tell that to an Afghan child whose family has been blown away by Obama's bombs, or a Pakistani child whose house has been visited by one of Obama's drones, or a Palestinian child surveying the carnage in Gaza caused by American smart weapons, which, disclosed Seymour Hersh, were resupplied to Israel for use in the slaughter, and I quote, only after the Obama team let it be known it would not object. The man who stayed silent on Gaza is the man who now condemns Iran. In a sense, Obama is the myth that is America's last taboo. His most consistent theme was never change, it was power. The United States, he said, and I quote, leads the world in battling immediate evils and promoting the ultimate good. We must lead by building a 21st century military to ensure the security of our people and advance the security of all people. And there is this remarkable statement, and I quote, at moments of great peril in the past century, our leaders ensured that America, by deed and by example, led and lifted the world, that we stood and fought for the freedom sought by billions of people beyond our borders. Unquote. Words like these remind me of the colonel in the village in Vietnam as he spun much the same nonsense. Since 1945, by deed and by example, to use Obama's words, America has overthrown 50 governments, including democracies, and crushed some 30 liberation movements, and bombed countless men, women, and children to death. I'm grateful to Bill Blum for his cataloguing of that. And yet here is the 45th president of the United States having stacked his government with warmongers and corporate fraudsters and polluters from the Bush and Clinton eras promising not only more of the same, but a whole new war in Pakistan, justified by the murderous cliches of Hillary Clinton, cliches like high-value targets. Within 3 days of his inauguration, Obama was ordering the death of people in faraway countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan. And yet, the peace movement, it seems, is prepared to look the other way and believe that the cool Obama will restore, as Krugman wrote, the nation of moral ideals. Not long ago, I visited the American Museum of History in the celebrated Smithsonian Institute in Washington. One of the most popular exhibitions was called The Price of Freedom, Americans at War. It was holiday time, and lines of happy people, including many children, shuffled through a Santa's grotto of war and conquest, where messages about their nation's great mission were lit up. These included tributes to the, quote, and I quote, exceptional Americans who saved a million lives, unquote, in Vietnam, where they were, quote, determined to stop communist expansion, unquote. In Iraq, other brave Americans, quote, employed airstrikes of unprecedented precision, unquote. What was shocking was not so much the revisionism of two of the epic crimes of modern times, but the sheer scale of omission. Like all U.S. presidents, Bush and Obama have very much in common. The wars of both presidents, and the wars of Clinton and Reagan, Carter and Ford, Nixon and Kennedy, are justified by the enduring myth of exceptional America. A myth the late Harold Pinter described as, and I quote, a brilliant, witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. The clever young man who recently made it to the White House is a very fine hypnotist, partly because it is indeed extraordinary to see an African American at the pinnacle of power in the land of slavery. However, this is the 21st century, and race, together with gender and even class, can be very seductive tools of propaganda. For what is so often overlooked and what matters, I believe, above all, is the class one serves. George Bush's inner circle, from the State Department to the Supreme Court, was perhaps the most multiracial in presidential history. It was PC par excellence. Think Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell. It was also the most reactionary. Obama's very presence in the White House appears to reaffirm the moral nation. He's a marketing dream. But like Calvin Klein or Benetton, he is a brand that promises something special, something exciting, almost risque, as if he might be radical, as if he might enact change. He makes people feel good. He's a postmodern man with no political baggage, and all that's fake. In his book, Dreams from My Father, Obama refers to the job he took after he graduated from Columbia in 1983. He describes his employer as, and I quote, a consulting house to multinational corporations, unquote. For some reason, he doesn't say who his employer was or what he did there. The employer was Business International Corporation, which has a long history of providing cover for the CIA with covert action and infiltrating unions and the left. I know this because it was especially active in my own country, Australia. Obama doesn't say what he did at Business International, and there may be absolutely nothing sinister, but it seems worthy of inquiry and debate as a clue to perhaps who the man is. During his brief period in the Senate, Obama voted to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He voted for the Patriot Act. He refused to support a bill for single-payer health care. He supported the death penalty. As a presidential candidate, he received more corporate backing than John McCain. He promised to close Guantanamo as a priority, but instead he's excused torture, reinstated military commissions, kept the Bush gulag intact, and opposed habeas corpus. Daniel Ellsberg, the great whistleblower, was right, I believe, when he said that under Bush a military coup had taken place in the United States, giving the Pentagon unprecedented powers. These powers have been reinforced by the presence of Robert Gates, a Bush family crony, and George W. Bush's powerful Secretary of Defense, and by all the Bush Pentagon officials and generals who have kept their jobs under Obama. In the middle of a recession, with millions of Americans losing their jobs and homes, Obama has increased the military budget. In Colombia, he is planning to spend $46 million on a new military base that will support a regime backed by death squads and further the tragic history of Washington's intervention in that region. In a pseudo-event in Prague, Obama promised a world without nuclear weapons to a global audience mostly unaware that America is building new tactical nuclear weapons designed to blur the distinction between nuclear and conventional war. Like George Bush, he used the absurdity of Europe threatened by Iran to justify building a missile system aimed at Russia and China. In another pseudo-event at the Annapolis Naval Academy, decked with flags and uniforms, Obama lied that America had gone to Iraq to bring freedom to that country. He announced that the troops were coming home. This was another deception. The head of the Army, General George Casey, says with some authority that America will be in Iraq for up to a decade. Other generals say 15 years. Chris Hedges, the very fine author of Empire of Illusion, puts it very well. President Obama, he wrote, does one thing and brand Obama gets you to believe another. This is the essence of successful advertising. You buy or do what the advertiser wants because of how they make you feel. Unquote. And so you are kept in a perpetual state of childishness. He calls this junk politics. But I think the real tragedy is that Obama, the brand, appears to have crippled or absorbed much of the anti-war movement, the peace movement. Out of 256 Democrats in Congress, 30, just 30, are willing to stand up against Obama's and Nancy Pelosi's war party. On June the 16th, they voted for $106 billion for more war. The out of Iraq caucus is out of action. Its members can't even come up with a form of words of why they are silent. On March the 21st, a demonstration at the Pentagon by the once mighty United for Peace and Justice drew only a few thousand. The outgoing president of UPJ, Leslie Kagan, says her people aren't turning up because, and I quote, it's enough for many of them that Obama has a plan to end the war and that things are moving in the right direction, unquote. And where is the mighty Move On these days? Where is its campaign against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? And what exactly was said when Move On's executive director, Jason Rubin, met Barack Obama at the White House in February? Yes, a lot of good people mobilized for Obama. But what did they demand of him? Working to elect a Democratic presidential candidate may seem like activism, but it isn't. Activism doesn't give up. Activism doesn't fall silent. Activism doesn't rely on the opiate of hope. Woody Allen once said, I felt a lot better when I gave up hope. I like that. Real activism has little time for identity politics, which, like exceptionalism, can be fake. These are distractions that confuse and sucker good people. And not only in the United States, I can assure you. I write for the Italian socialist newspaper Il Manifesto, or rather I used to write for it. In February, I sent the editor an article which raised questions about Obama as a progressive force. The article was rejected. Why, I asked. For the moment, wrote the editor, we prefer to maintain a more positive approach to the novelty presented by Obama. We will take on specific issues, but we would not like to say that he will make no difference. Unquote. In other words, an American president drafted to promote the most rapacious system in history is ordained and depoliticized by important sections of the left. It's a remarkable situation. Remarkable because those on the so-called radical left have never been more aware, more conscious of the iniquities of power. The Green Movement, for example, has raised the consciousness of millions so that almost every child knows something about global warming. And yet, there seems to be a resistance within the Green Movement to the notion of power as a military force, a military project. And perhaps similar observations can also be made about sections of the feminist movement and the gay movement, and certainly the union movement. One of my favorite quotations is from Milan Kundera. The struggle of people against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. We should never forget that the primary goal of great power is to distract and limit our natural desire for social justice and equity and real democracy. Long ago, Edward Bernays's invisible government of propaganda elevated big business from its unpopular status as a kind of mafia to that of a patriotic driving force. The American way of life began as an advertising slogan. The modern image of Santa Claus was an invention of Coca-Cola. Today, we are presented with an extraordinary opportunity. Thanks to the crash of Wall Street and the revelation for many ordinary people that the free market has nothing to do with freedom. The opportunity within our grasp is to recognize that something is stirring in America that is unfamiliar, perhaps, to many of us on the left, but is related to a great popular movement that's growing all over the world. Look down at Latin America. Less than 20 years ago, there was the usual despair, the usual divisions of poverty and freedom, the usual thugs in uniforms running unspeakable regimes. Today, for the first time, perhaps in 500 years, there's a people's movement based on the revival of indigenous cultures and language, a genuine populism. The recent amazing achievements in Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, El Salvador, Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay represent a struggle for community and political rights that is truly historic, with implications for all of us. The successes in Latin America are expressed perversely in the recent overthrow of the government of Honduras, because the smaller the country, the greater is the threat of a good example that the disease of emancipation will spread. Indeed, right across the world, social movements and grassroots organizations have emerged to fight free market dogma. They've educated governments in the South that food for export is a problem rather than a solution to global poverty. They've politicized ordinary people to stand up for their rights, as in the Philippines and South Africa. Look at the remarkable boycott, disinvestment and sanctions campaign, BDS for short, aimed at Israel, that's sweeping the world. Israeli ships have been turned away from South Africa and Western Australia. A French company has been forced to abandon plans to build a railway connecting Jerusalem with illegal Israeli settlements. Israeli sporting bodies find themselves isolated. Universities in the United Kingdom have begun to sever ties with Israel. This is how apartheid South Africa was defeated. And this is how the great wind of the 1960s began to blow. And this is how every gain has been won. The end of slavery, universal suffrage, workers' rights, civil rights, environmental protection, the list goes on and on. And that brings us back here to the United States. As I believe, something is stirring in this country. Are we aware that in the last eight months, millions of angry emails sent by ordinary Americans have flooded Washington? And I mean millions. People are outright outraged that their lives are attacked. They bear no resemblance to the passive mass presented by the media. Look at the polls. More than two-thirds of Americans say the government should care for those who cannot care for themselves. 64% would pay higher taxes to guarantee health care for everyone. 60% are favorable towards unions. 70% want nuclear disarmament. 72% want the US completely out of Iraq, and so on and so on. But where is much of the left? Where is the social justice movement? Where is the peace movement? Where is the civil rights movement? Ordinary Americans for too long have been misrepresented by stereotypes that are contemptuous. James Madison referred to his compatriots in the public as ignorant and meddlesome outsiders. And this contempt is probably as strong today among the elite as it was back then. That's why the progressive attitudes of the public are seldom reported in the media, because they're not ignorant, they're subversive, they're informed, and they're even anti-American. I once asked a friend, the great American war correspondent and humanitarian Martha Gellhorn, to explain the term anti-American to me. "I'll tell you what anti-American is," she said in her forceful way. "It's what governments and their vested interests call those who honor America by objecting to war and the theft of resources and believing in all of humanity. There are millions of these anti-Americans in the United States. They are ordinary people. They are ordinary people who belong to no elite and who judge their government in moral terms, though they would call it common decency. They are not vain. They are the people with a wakeful conscience. The best of American citizens, of America's citizens. Sure, they disappear from view now and then, but they are like seeds beneath the snow. I would say they are truly exceptional." Truly exceptional. I like that. My own guess is that a populism is growing once again in America, evoking a powerful force beneath the surface which has a proud history. From such authentic grassroots Americanism came women's suffrage, the eight-hour day, graduated income tax, public ownership of railways and communications, the breaking of the power of corporate lobbyists, and much more. In other words, real democracy. The American populace were far from perfect, but they often spoke for ordinary people, and they were betrayed by leaders who urged them to compromise and merge with the Democratic Party. That was long ago, but how familiar it sounds. My guess is that something is coming again. The signs are there. Noam Chomsky is right when he says that mere sparks can ignite a popular movement that may seem dormant. No one predicted 1968, no one predicted the fall of apartheid, or the Berlin Wall, or the civil rights movement, or the great Latino rising of a few years ago. I suggest that we take Woody Allen's advice and give up on hope, and listen instead to voices from below. What Obama and the bankers and the generals and the IMF and the CIA and CNN and BBC. Fear is ordinary people coming together and acting together. It's a fear as old as democracy, a fear that suddenly people convert their anger to action, as they've done so often throughout history. At a time of universal deceit, wrote George Orwell, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. Thank you.
This is Radio Anguindian. Anguindian Radio for the Fourth World.
That the Brazilian Civilian Internet Framework is an example of open, multi-sectorial, multilateral, democratic, and transparent internet access. We are the first country in the world to have a law to consolidate internet as a free and democratic space essential to social participation, innovation, and mainly for citizens' use, stressed Rousseff in her regular Monday radio program, Coffee with the President. She emphasized that the law was well received and is considered a pattern for improving democratization of the global power of cyberspace, as formatted at the